Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll discuss the troubles in the newspaper industry. Illinois has had more of the publications shut down than other states. We'll discuss some of the challenges. A high school senior from Illinois recently traveled to Plains, Georgia to pay tribute to former President Jimmy Carter. We'll hear his story. Young Muslim girls in the Chicago area are finding a new pastime, basketball. We'll also learn about an effort to teach respect for sports officials and hear how a ban on cell phones in schools is going so far. Research shows droughts have an impact on wildlife, affecting animal behavior and causing some species to leave certain areas. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A few years ago, an administrator at Eureka College noticed a pattern with incoming students. She saw a need for additional support in college-level writing, but it wasn't quite that simple. Students weren't writing well because they were also struggling to read at a college level. Lindsay Jones talked with Eureka's provost and vice president of academic affairs, Ann Fullup, about a new position the college has created to help get the students up to speed.
So writing is the way that students express critical thinking, right, and the higher level thinking skills. And so when we uncovered that the issue with the writing was the reading comprehension, we said we need to address this problem. Now, this goes beyond our students with reading disabilities, right? The dyslexia, they're usually accommodated. That's not the issue. Illiteracy rates are rising in America and have been, and we get students from all over the country. So this isn't an Illinois-centric issue. This is students coming to us from many states that just have, for whatever reason, however their schools taught them to read, didn't teach them to read, how what they were reading, weren't reading in high school, they're not reading at the level that we need them to read at to be able to effectively write. And so this position is meant to give them that extra comprehension, that extra vocabulary, extra kind of reading strategies to move them from the level that they're at, which is not, they're literate, of course, right? But to get them ready for the college level of reading.
Much was made a while back about a particular type of, maybe you would call it pedagogy or methodology, that was used broadly in schools across the country to teach reading. And It may or may not have been as effective as it was initially portrayed. Is what we're seeing at the higher education level as students come in, is it possibly related to that?
It could possibly be a factor. I do not know how every one of my students was taught English in their K through 12 or taught to read in their K through 12. Considering that that program was nationwide and considering I'm seeing this from students from all different states, it could be a factor, right? And I'm sure the pandemic didn't help, right? This is that age group was affected that way.
So I understand that you're provost now and your discipline was psychology, but did you see any of the broader trends that people have talked about with regard to students really immersing themselves in a substantive text and their ability to do that?
I haven't in the students that I've been teaching. My faculty is telling me there's been a shift, right? That they have to spend, I think, more time. I used to teach students how to read primary text because you're teaching scientific literacy at the same time that you're teaching that. That wasn't expected, right? Students don't know how to read. You have to learn to read journal articles in college. That's not something that's a high school curriculum. But I have noticed that faculty are struggling to get students to read longer text now than they have in the past. So there has been somewhat of that shift. And again, is that because students just don't want to, or is that because it's more difficult for them to do it? So it actually takes them more time to do it than it took a previous generation. And that's partly what we're trying to figure out.
Does it make it more challenging for faculty to have to figure out a way to sort of not start from scratch, but really start from a beginning point that they may not have been used to starting from?
Yeah, you have to have expert teachers. You have to have people that are really good in the classroom to shift their pedagogy and shift their strategies. And I'm really fortunate that Eureka College has such a stellar teaching faculty that are terminally degreed and really good at their stuff and really student-centric. And we keep our class sizes small enough that they can pivot and maneuver and adjust, and they talk about their teaching strategies with each other all the time.
Eureka College's Provost and Vice President of Academic Affairs, Ann Fullup, speaking with Lindsay Jones about a new reading specialist position the college has created. The specialist will serve 20 to 25 students once established. A high school senior, London Wollenweber of Bloomington, is a political junkie. He's so into politics, he wanted his senior photos taken in Washington, D.C. One of them was with U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. London's political hero is the late President Jimmy Carter, and he and his mother just drove down to Plains, Georgia to pay their respects to the late president. He spoke about it with Charlie Schlinker.
So about 4 years ago, I asked my mother to make me a promise that when Jimmy Carter passed away, that she would take me to see him. But my journey with politics began in 2016 with that election cycle between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And then from there, I started researching, different politicians. And Jimmy Carter stood out to me, not as a politician, but as a human.
Why?
I think Jimmy Carter, we don't see it a lot in our politicians today, but he was just genuine with everybody. The work he did after the presidency really showed that he cared not only about the people in Plains, but the people around the world. Eradicating diseases, making sure other countries had free and fair elections. He kind of changed, what it meant to be a politician. And so moving forward, I do hope that more politicians look at him and decide to be more like him.
How could that happen?
I think it could be a very easy change for many politicians, just go to the communities, talk to people. Because one thing about Jimmy Carter is when you're in Plains, Georgia, people have stories to tell. They're always good stories. Me and my mom never heard any bad stories about Jimmy Carter. So I think our politicians just need to get out there in the communities they serve, and they just need to, be a voice for them and know what's wrong and then how they can fix it.
What did you see in Plains?
So in Plains, on the first day we were there, it was basically a celebration of Jimmy Carter. People were there telling stories, and his family was just like walking around. We saw Chip Carter there. And, we went into one store, the Plains Trading Post, and the guy there and his wife had known the Carters for years. That store sells political memorabilia. And so the people in Plains, they just love him, and they love Rosalynn. They had a lot of stories to tell. And one of them that has stuck with me is while we were in the row to wait for the procession to go on, for his motorcade to come through, a older lady was talking to us, and she mentioned she was a former National Park Ranger. She said that when she had to leave her job there to move to a nearby city, how Jimmy Carter wrote her a long, beautiful letter. And so I think that just kind of shows the man Jimmy Carter was. He didn't let his power get a hold of him. He was still human, and he made sure people knew that. Another story that has stuck with me is how he would just walk into people's houses and talked to them. A lady said that he walked into her house and took a chair and said, "I'll be back tomorrow and it'll be fixed."
Talk about your interaction with Chip Carter, would you?
Yeah, so me and my mom, actually, we were at a old antique store and this lady came up to us and she kind of adopted us for the day in Plains, Georgia. And she said, "Let's go to their old apartment." And so we did. We didn't know about the apartment. It's where it was public housing because the Carters couldn't afford to, rent or own a home in Plains. And so we went there, and they were doing a interview for MSNBC at the time with Chip Carter, walking through, giving a tour. And so about 30 minutes later, he walked out, and he had a conversation with us, asked me where I was going to school, and, just, like, why we were there. And we said, like, "Sorry for your loss," and how such a great man Jimmy Carter was. And he listened, he understood, and he took the time out of his crazy schedule, because he has all these funerals and things to attend to, just to listen to us.
Back on the public service point, one of the Greek philosophers said that no person can be totally virtuous if they are a politician. And the idea is that you have to make compromises. You can't be militant about standing for truth or any particular principle if you're faced with a reality that is muddy and not black and white. How can you take Carter's example and yet still acknowledge that truth?
So Jimmy Carter is a politician, and I think not all politicians are good, but Jimmy Carter kind of took what it meant to be a politician and I think changed it. He didn't come from money, which is, we see a lot of money in politics nowadays, but Jimmy Carter didn't come from money. He came from a small town in Georgia with a peanut farm, and he started his campaign from nothing. His first like rally had 4 people at it. I think Carter kind of just changed how it meant to be a politician. He also campaigned. One of the things he continued to say while campaigning is he would never tell a lie, which is something, you know, we don't see politicians doing nowadays because a lot of them do lie. But Carter campaigned on telling the truth, and he continued to do that even after public service.
What part of President Carter's post-presidency work rises highest in your mind?
There's a lot that he did after the presidency. You know, he did lose badly to Reagan, and so for him to come back and create the Carter Center and work around the world was unimaginable nowadays. But one of the things that stands out to me the most is how he went to other countries to make sure they had free and fair elections, making sure the people in those countries could elect a president that, you know, they felt represented them the best, but also how he volunteered with Habitat for Humanity and went to other countries to build homes. You know, that's something that we don't see a lot nowadays. And he just kind of worked towards a better world instead of a better America.
We humans tell ourselves stories to shape our lives. How is President Carter's journey shaping yours?
You know, as someone who does want to go into politics, I kind of had a similar life of Jimmy Carter, other than not really a small town. But I didn't come from money. You know, both my parents had to work tirelessly to, you know, make sure we can go on vacations, have food and all everything. And so to see Jimmy Carter go from that all the way to the state Senate, to the governor's mansion, all the way up to the White House, you know, that's, you know, an American dream. And he represents that. And I hope someday that I'm able to take what he did and, you know, do my own journey with politics.
You have a plan for each step? Or?
I do. I've thought about, you know, my journey with politics a lot. I'm going to the University of Illinois at Springfield for political science, and I see myself interning there and in D.C., depending on, you know, what I can get. And then, you know, if I want to work in D.C., I'm going to try to do that. But I do see myself maybe running for politics in the future, whether that be local or nationwide.
What part of public service appeals to you?
You know, being able to have a voice, whether that be at the local, state, or national level, I think is a privilege that only a little bit of people have. I like to listen to people's stories, and so being able to listen to people's stories, know what they're going through, can help me in a way that I can decide what to vote on, what to, you know, bring up to votes.
That's high school senior Lyndon Wollenweber. He traveled to Plains, Georgia with his mother to pay respects to the late president, Jimmy Carter. Basketball leagues for young Muslim girls are springing up around the Chicago area. They're encouraging more girls to get into sports while celebrating their Muslim identity. Anna Savchinka picks up the story from the sidelines.
I'm at a Park District gym in suburban Woodridge, where a dozen teen girls are warming up for basketball practice, currently doing defensive drills. The girls stop mid-practice for a water break, and some of them put on their hoodies and line up in the middle of the court with their shoes off and kneel down in prayer. They're joined in prayer by some of their parents and their coach, Amina Chaudhry. For the girls, the scene is routine. But it's symbolic of a major shift among Muslim girls in the Chicago area, where a growing number of them are getting into sports like basketball. Here's Coach Chaudhry.
We have girls in our program who had never even thought about playing basketball, never picked up a basketball a day in their life, but they saw the marketing for a program in the mosque, and it's for girls, and they brought their parents brought them out, and they realized the athletic ability that they have and the basketball talent they have.
One catalyst is a 2021 law that allows Illinois students to modify their sports clothing in schools without needing a waiver from their school district. For Muslim girls, that means they no longer need to get permission to wear a hijab or leggings and long sleeves underneath their uniforms to practice modesty, which is core to their faith.
Ariana's the one right there in the middle, with the white shoe, white, pink, and blue shoes on.
Shamsa Jaffrey sits in the bleachers, watching her daughter's practice. She says the change in state law removes a barrier that she faced as a kid.
It wasn't even heard of in, like, sports to be able to wear clothing or wear a uniform that would align with our religion.
But some young girls are still getting questioned about their clothing choices, like 14-year-old Noreen Magda. When she started playing in a Park District basketball league in the northwest suburbs 3 years ago, she got asked,
like, why wear leggings? Like, do I get hot? Like, when I was fasting, and they're like, oh, can't you just cheat? Like, I commend you, because I would totally cheat.
Her dad, Janaid, heard similar stories from other parents. So a few of them got together and formed a basketball league for their girls. They called it Muslima Ballers, and they turned to their local mosque in Morden Grove to recruit some 70 players. Dads volunteered to coach, Janaid included, even though his three daughters were all on different teams.
If I was coaching one, that means I 50% chance I was coaching against another. So I tried to avoid coaching because then there would be problems back at home if I coached one.
Sana, Noreen's mom, wishes leagues like this existed when she was a kid in public school and wasn't allowed to cover up.
I asked the coach once, you know, can I wear sweatpants? And he was like, no, you have to wear shorts. And that's when I just completely, I didn't even ask twice. I didn't have that confidence.
She says it's rewarding to see her daughter do something she wasn't able to.
I mean, she plays confidently, and it makes me very proud. Sometimes when I see her, I'm actually, like, in tears because you don't see girls go that far.
Noreen now plays on her high school basketball team, and Sana credits the league for helping Noreen find the words and the courage to explain to those who ask why she chooses to cover up. Noreen looks up to Bilqis Abdul-Kadir, a Muslim American basketball player who was the first NCAA Division I player to wear hijab while competing.
She, like, really promotes playing with hijab. I'm like, for me, I'm not ready for that yet, but it's something I aspire to be able to do.
I'm Nassaf Shinkadabi, BEZ News.
More ahead on Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A few years ago, the number of youth sports referees in Illinois nosedived, and the number one reason refs were leaving? Verbal abuse from fans and coaches. Peter Medlin reports in an effort to remind us referees are human too.
If you've ever played or even watched sports, this is probably a pretty familiar scene. A parent, coach, or fan yelling at a referee at a youth sports game. Maybe you've even yelled at a ref or two from the comfort of your own living room watching on TV. They're easy targets in their zebra-striped shirts. But mistreating youth sports officials has real consequences for the kids who are there to play. Kurt Gibson is the director of officiating at the Illinois High School Association.
Our officiating numbers had dropped to a low point, and schools were really struggling to find officials to work all the games they had on their schedules.
Right as sports were ramping back up after COVID disruptions, IHSA had fewer refs than they'd had in at least a decade. For every 100 newly patched refs, 70 to 80 will be gone after their first few years.
The treatment they were receiving mostly from fans was the reason people were leaving.
That's why IHSA has been partnering with Officially Human for the past 2 years. Officially Human produces PSAs and training videos to ask fans and coaches to put themselves in a referee's shoes and whistle.
Sports fans, we cheer on our favorite teams at fields, gyms, arenas, and stadiums. But have you ever wondered what it's like to be a referee?
Brenda Hilton is the CEO and founder of Officially Human, and she says their PSAs and videos had to be deeper than please don't be a jerk. For example, their course for coaches asked them to consider the craft of officiating and think about why people become refs in the first place.
Each section kind of takes somebody along the journey of an official. So Ralph is the official in the video. How did Ralph become an official? He was an ex-athlete. He wanted to stay involved with the game. He's got a wife, two kids.
That's true for so many officials. Many played growing up, often through the college level, and Officially Human surveyed thousands of refs, and 70% said they'd do it for the love of the game. That's certainly the case for Jeff Carr. He's been refereeing football from 10-year-olds all the way up to the Big Ten for nearly a half century. He played college football, wanted to stay connected to the game he loved, and found that through officiating. And he puts a ton of work into his craft. It means going to seminars, watching film of his game, and seeing how coaches teach techniques and what he can watch for.
Going to practices and stuff with these schools and hear the way they're being coached and stuff gives you a whole different insight into the game.
Jeff Miles is another longtime referee, and his story is similar to the other Jeff's. He played and loved sports growing up and wanted to stay in the game. At first, it was about making some extra money, too, but for Miles, refereeing is also about giving back to his community.
It has brought me great joy and comfort. It's a way of life for me now.
On top of helping kids, he says it helped him grow a lot as well.
Your preparation, being to the game an hour beforehand, dealing with your conflict resolution skills.
Those conflict resolution skills are crucial when fan or coach behavior gets out of hand. And unfortunately, he does see it a lot.
When the game's over, we still have to walk outside to our car. And sometimes that can be difficult. You're looking over your shoulder.
There are other challenges, too. They don't get paid much. For high school varsity games, Miles would make around $80 a game. When you have a referee shortage, sometimes they just don't have enough people. Sometimes inexperienced officials are forced to cover games they're not ready for, which can lead to mistakes. And then the officiating itself is difficult. At IHSA, the number of refs is starting to rebound. They've made several changes to make it easier to become an official and to give great refs recognition, but Kurt Gibson says their officially human partnership has played a key role. Because officials do play a key role. Youth sports can be really important in a kid's life, and without refs, there's no game. I'm Peter Medlin.
Indiana passed a new law that's impacting students. It restricts cell phones in schools. Many districts in Illinois have either adopted a similar policy or at least considered it. Seven states have passed such laws, but how is the restriction playing out in the classroom? Last year, Lee Gaines visited two Indiana high schools to get the story. We revisit that report.
Okay, guys. That's the bell.
It's a couple weeks into a brand new school year at Lawrence North High School in Indianapolis. Math teacher Jenny Guimont is eager to start her Algebra 1 class. But first,
all phones, headphones, AirPods, tablets, gotta go in the bag. Zip them up, please.
That's because a new Indiana state law now restricts the use of phones and other devices in schools. Last fall, nearly three quarters of U.S. high school teachers said cell phones were a major problem in classrooms. That's according to a study by Pew Research Center.
Guys, listen up. Inverse operations.
In response to this problem, a handful of states have passed laws or enacted policies that aim to restrict the use of cell phones in schools. According to an Education Week analysis, six of these measures take effect this school year, including Indiana's.
I'm overall very happy about it.
That's teacher Jenny Guimont again.
It makes my job easier to know that the law is behind me, you know, that basically now I have something to support my message.
Prior to this year, it was up to each teacher at Lawrence North to decide if or how students could use their devices. Now, under the law, unless a student needs it for a medical reason or a disability, they can't be on their phone during class. Lawrence North senior Taylor Smith says it's changed the way he uses his phone in school.
I won't say that I needed like somebody else to tell me to get off my phone, but I will say that it's going to help me a great deal to have that thought in the back of my mind saying, wait, this is illegal.
It's up to schools to come up with their own discipline procedures. At Lawrence North, students who have their phones out during class can get a referral, basically a note in their school records. They may also have to hand their phone over to a teacher for the rest of class. That's also true for students caught using their cell phones at Beech Grove High School, about a 20-minute drive south of Lawrence North. Beech Grove sophomore Jaden Howard says he used to secretly be on his phone during class.
And last year, I had a whole bunch of missing assignments.
Now, he wouldn't risk it.
And this year, I feel like I'm paying attention more and more focused.
But not all students agree the law has helped them.
Basically, like last year, there was not a point in my day where I did not have a headphone in listening to something, and now I can't listen to anything.
Grace Wingfield is a senior at Beech Grove. She says music helped her stay focused during quiet work time at school, and without it, she says she's struggling to concentrate.
I think that's probably the hardest part for me of this whole phone reel, just not having music.
This is something I heard from a lot of students. Martin Barker, an instructional coach at Beech Grove, says headphones are a mixed bag.
Some students, that absolutely locks them in if they're really distracted by the classroom. But I have other students that, like, absolutely music just completely distracts them and they can't focus on what they're supposed to do.
Barker thinks this law will benefit more than it will hurt. And he's already seeing students more focused on their schoolwork this year. His colleague, Beech Grove English teacher Josie DeFries, says she's noticed another benefit.
I feel like my classrooms are loud again.
Last year, DeFries says when students had downtime, their heads were buried in their phones, and it was quiet. This year, that's changed.
The kids turn to each other and talk, or they start drawing on my board, or they ask me for questions with their homework, and it just becomes a lot more lively, interactive environment.
She hopes it stays that way. For NPR News, I'm Lee Gaines in Indianapolis.
Science has been studying the growing of crops for a long time, but the study of soil is relatively new. Researchers are finding there's a lot to be learned about how farming has impacted soil over the decades. And in this Encore piece, Harvest Public Media's Jim Meadows reports the discovery of century-old soil samples could greatly help that research.
On a Sunday morning in August of 2018, University of Illinois soil scientist Andrew Margonaut drove out to a dilapidated barn on the campus farm. Inside, using a headlamp to pierce the darkness, Margonaut discovered a treasure trove.
I realized within about 5 minutes of walking through these cobwebbed, very dark hallways that there were row upon row, shelf upon shelf of soils, and that these were the original soils taken in the mapping of the state.
There were thousands of soil samples stored in mason jars and other sealed containers going back as far as the 1860s. The soil, taken from nearly every Illinois county, mostly in the early 1900s, was used to map soil types and help farmers determine growing conditions. The collection was orphaned in 2003 after the death of the last researcher to work with it. Professor Margonaut says his rediscovery sent his mind reeling with the research possibilities.
I didn't sleep for about 2 nights because I was so excited by all the things that we could answer.
Margonaut is contacting farmers and landowners so he can take new soil samples in the same locations. He wants to study how the soil has changed over more than a century to learn about long-term changes in nutrients, microbial activity, and soil stability. That's a rare opportunity. U.S. Department of Agriculture soil scientist Mark Liebig says the soil samples in most soil archives are less than 40 years old.
The average human lifespan now is right around 73 years. With the exception of a few places across the globe, we really don't know how the soil changes over that duration of time.
Liebig says he believes many older soil archives that did exist have been lost either forever or until they're found again. At Penn State University, another collection showed up in a storage closet 4 years ago. The samples date from 1915 and 1933 from a now-demolished test plot on campus. Rita Grafe with Penn State's Pasto Agricultural Museum says nowadays they can analyze the soils in new ways, even reviving the soil's dormant microbes.
But we need to preserve these collections because in the future, there might be technologies that let us further understand what was happening in the soil then so that we can make decisions going forward.
We also have the Morrow plot samples going back to 1904 up here as well.
Okay.
So it's a
at the University of Illinois today, thousands of jars of soil line shelves in a much newer barn. Margonaut picks one up.
And this one, for example, this is a good example of a jar where the label is not in great shape, as you can see.
But a little paper inside the jar gives more information. Marginot is using all that data to reach out to landowners and ask permission to take new soil samples at more than 450 specific locations. So far, he's gotten around 60. One of those new samples comes from John Kiefner's farm southwest of Chicago.
I see it as an avenue for me to maybe get more educated and become a little smarter. I'm really curious to see how this soil has changed from 1957 to 2024.
Kiefner adopted no-till farming more than three decades ago. He hopes to learn that he's actually improved his soil, or at least not harmed it. I'm Jim Meadows.
Much of the Midwest and Great Plains have been dealing with extremely dry conditions for the past 4 years. It's killed crops, lowered river levels, and fueled wildfires. But the extreme weather also affects wildlife. As Elizabeth Rimbert reports, drought conditions can change animal behavior and even push species out of some regions.
A small pond sits near the end of County Road F in western Nebraska. At first, it looks like a typical pond off a quiet, dead-end gravel road. But after nearly 20 years of visiting this pond every summer, Larkin Powell is pretty good at spotting its residents.
Look at like all the heads. There's the little bumps sticking up in the water.
Oh, that's
like all the way back. Those are the turtles.
Those are the turtles. Yeah.
This pond is a painted turtle hotspot. Powell teaches conservation biology and animal ecology at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Every summer, he brings students out to this pond to catch and measure the turtles. A handful have fallen into the traps floating in the pond. Now, the irritated turtles are scratching around in buckets, waiting their turn to be measured by the crew of students, who are ready with thick gloves, calipers, and scales.
59, armpit to armpit.
He's kicking me. He's kicking me good. He's going back in his bucket.
Powell and his students used 11 years of these measurements to study how drought impacted the turtles. They found that during dry years, the turtles grew more slowly. The conditions also seem to lower survival and throw off the female-to-male ratio. The papers have been Powell's most requested research studies. He says scientists are starting to realize that climate change means animals are reckoning with new conditions.
Now that those droughts are becoming more frequent and more intense, there's going to be some changes, and we have to account for that as we think about the future for species of conservation concern.
The last few years of drought have been a doozy. In early November, more than 79% of the country's population was living with abnormal dryness and drought, a record in the U.S. Drought Monitor's 25-year history. Persistently high temperatures and low precipitation has transformed creeks and ponds into puddles in Kansas and Missouri. It's killed off fish and ruined habitats for migrating birds. In Indiana, the extreme heat and dryness of the 2012 drought wiped out the Karner butterfly. The small powder blue butterfly hasn't been seen there since 2014. And other animals are being seen where they shouldn't be.
Right now, a bear cub is making headlines in West St. Louis County.
Never thought I would see a wild bear in front of my house.
Black bears usually prefer to stay away from people. But Missouri Department of Conservation biologist Nate Bowersock says they're more willing to risk human contact when dry conditions kill the acorns and berries they rely on. That may mean they wander into the burbs or onto farms.
They might start trying to flip over a chicken coop to get at the chickens or decimate a beehive. Bird feeders, too. They love to go after people's bird feeders.
While droughts are a part of the natural weather cycle, scientists have found that human-caused climate change is making them more frequent and more intense. Wynn Moss, a biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey, says it's getting harder for wildlife to survive drought, as they also fight off disease, invasive species, and habitat loss.
So drought just adds another threat to that list, and it can be kind of the death blow for some of these species.
That threat is getting more persistent, according to Moss. Even when drought conditions ease, the effects can stick around. And wildlife is often hit by another drought before they're back to normal.
They're happening so fast that ecosystems are finding it challenging to fully recover before the next drought happens.
Back at the pond in western Nebraska, the turtles have done their scientific duty. It's time for them to go back home. The students walk down to the pond, set the buckets on their sides, and watch as the turtles slowly make their way to the water. They float on the surface before swimming out, only their little heads visible above the water.
Hi, friends.
Painted turtles are a stable population that aren't existentially threatened by drought. But Powell hopes the findings can be applied to other endangered turtle species that might need help surviving the new normal of extreme heat and dryness. I'm Elizabeth Rembert, Harvest Public Media.
Still ahead on Statewide, we'll talk about the decline of the newspaper industry. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford.
Western Illinois University no longer has an interim president. Western's board voted unanimously to name Christy Mindrup as the institution's 13th president in December. And Rich Egger reports.
Mindrup had served as interim president since April 1st. She replaced Guiyu Wong, who left before his contract was up. Board Chairperson Karen Stutz says since then, Mindrup proved to be the right leader for Western.
Is there a better vetting process than seeing someone actually do the job for 8 months?
Mindrup is Western's first female president in its 125-year history. She says she's received a lot of support since April.
You're the reason I'm sitting here, all of you in this room right now. You're the reason why I would consider doing this role back on April 1st. You're the reason I would consider doing it now in December.
Board members and others at the meeting gave Mindrup a standing ovation after the vote, but not everyone was happy with the outcome. Merrill Cole is president of Western's chapter of the University Professionals of Illinois, which represents faculty.
I take this as another example of the board simply bypassing shared governance.
Cole says he has nothing against Mindrup, but is disappointed with the process. He says the decision felt rushed. Trustee Derek Wise headed a committee to assess a presidential appointment. It conducted surveys that included input from faculty and other constituencies.
People had a chance to speak that wanted to participate, and that was the goal, participation.
Board members say the survey was not scientific, but it did help take the temperature in the room. Board Vice Chairperson Polly Radosh is a former Western faculty member and says she is an advocate for faculty, but she feels they are wrong to want a national presidential search done.
In my opinion, it would be foolish to push aside the first president in 5 years who has had the courage and insight to make the bold decisions that the board has been asking for. She's doing an exceptional job. She has excelled.
Radosh says during her 5 years on the board, Western has hired a president, two provosts, four vice presidents, and two deans, all through national searches.
And two of those people are still on campus. Two. We have a terrible record. A terrible record in national searches. We have serious problems facing the university. And people hired in national searches have not solved them in my 5 years on the board.
Radosh says Western has made progress in resolving its financial problems since April, which she attributed to Mindrup and her leadership team. Mindrup says her grandparents and an aunt showed her Western when she was a child and inspired her love for the university.
On a personal note, I so deeply care about Western Illinois University. It's in my blood.
She says it's humbling to be asked to lead the institution. Mindrup began her career at Western in 1997 when the university opened its Quad Cities campus in the IBM building in Moline. She started out as a clerk, answering phones at night and on weekends. Through the years, Mindrup has worked her way up through the ranks and was vice president of Quad Cities campus operations before being named interim president. Details of her contract are still being negotiated, but it will run through the end of June 2027. Rich Egger reporting.
Northern Illinois University's Board of Trustees approved a football-only move from the Mid-American Conference, or MAC, to the Mountain West Conference. Peter Medlin explains.
NIU President Lisa Freeman says the move to the Mountain West opens up more opportunities both in terms of revenue and recruiting during a dynamic era of college football marked by name, image, likeness agreements and conference realignment.
This move will allow us to grow our strong football national brand and will put all of our athletic programs on a more sustainable track moving forward.
The decision required board approval because joining the conference costs a $2 million membership fee payable in 6 installments. Freeman says the cost to transition to the Mountain West will be primarily offset by an expected increase in revenue from things like multimedia rights and ticket sales, and she says they do not plan to use existing institutional funds to pay for the transition. The Huskies will join the Mountain West in 2026. It's unclear at this point which conference NIU's other sports would compete in. I'm Peter Medlin. More than two newspapers shut their doors every week in the U.S. That's according to a study from the Medill School of Journalism. Closer to home, Illinois is among the leaders among states with the most number of newspaper closures in a year. At least five counties in the state are considered news deserts, and 40 Illinois counties only have one local news source. So what does the current state of the news industry mean for you? Tim Franklin is director of the Medill Local News Initiative, and he talked with Sasha Ann Simons.
So across the country, we have lost more than 100 newspapers and thousands of newspaper jobs in just the period of 1 year, Tim. So first, I really just want you to reflect on that reality. What comes to mind? What does it signal for you?
Well, what it signals is that we are living through a historic transformation in how news is consumed and how it's produced and how it's distributed and how it's paid for. And audiences have splintered into a million different platforms and websites and different offerings. And with them have gone advertisers who now are going to social media and other digital platforms to try to spread the word about their goods. And advertising 10 or 12 years ago made up 80% of a newspaper's base. And in the last decade, 60% of that advertising has vaporized. And so any industry that lost that large a percentage of its revenue base would be facing challenges. And so the result of all of these historic changes and changes in the business model is that we're seeing newspapers close on average of 2.5 per week.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, what it means in Illinois, which has been one of the hardest hit states in the nation, is that we've lost 86% of our newspaper journalists, 86% in the last 20 years. That's the highest rate in the nation.
That's a lot.
That's a lot. And it means less local coverage for communities. It means less information about what's happening in their communities. I mean, a great newspaper is one where a community sees itself.
Mm-hmm.
And when communities become blind to what's happening in their own areas, that has big implications for the civic health of a community and for our country ultimately.
Right. Yeah, let's talk more about what this means and what the picture looks like specifically here in Illinois.
Sure.
So you gave some stats there. I'll add to that list. Since 2005, more than a third of U.S. newspapers, so 3,300 outlets, they've closed. And in that time, Illinois lost 36% of its newspapers, or 232 outlets. And Cook County lost 40% of its newspapers. Illinois lost six papers just in the span of the year from September 2023 to September 2024, Tim. What can you tell us about those closures?
Well, you know, this past year has been especially tough for all media, but especially for the newspaper industry. So there was a loss of about 7,000 jobs just in the past year, which dwarfs the number from the previous year. And what we've seen is some of the social media platforms are de-emphasizing news. So news organizations are getting less traffic to their sites. from social media than they used to. And that traffic has generated programmatic ad revenue, which has helped support the journalism that they're producing. And so that has had a big impact. I think also there's this whole thing about news fatigue, which has been quantified by the Pew Research Center and others. Some people are just tuning out.
Yes.
Which is another problem. And then there's the trust issue, which I think is less of a problem for local news than it is for national news, but is still an issue.
Oh yeah, you're hearing a lot of people. You know, you scroll on social media, you tune into, just different news conversations, just turning to friends here and there. Lots of people talking about losing trust in legacy media, and of course we know the fake news jargon that started years ago, but that's kind of caught on. And so it just kind of leaves us in a terrible position as journalists who are telling the truth.
It does. And you know, I think with local journalism, and a lot of people just lump all the media together in a convenient sort of way. But local journalists are different. I mean, these are your neighbors. These are people you see at the Little League field or at the PTA meeting or at the library or cultural events in your community. They're simply trying to give you news and information that you need to live your life and help your family and understand what's happening in your local schools and with your local government, with local businesses. They don't have an ideological agenda. Their only agenda is to try to help do public service journalism that helps a community. And, you know, a lot of people say that they, well, I hate Congress, but I like my local congressperson. And I think that's also true with the media to some degree.
What role do the owners of news organizations play? Because we know some corporation chains that own news outlets, I mean, they're controlled by private equity or hedge funds. So what does that mean for a paper's longevity?
That's a good question. What it means is, in real terms, is that, and the reason that Illinois has a higher percentage loss of newspaper journalists than other states around the country is because a big number of the newspapers in Illinois are owned by large corporate chains. And several of those chains are owned either in all or in part by hedge funds or private equity. And private equity exists to try to deliver returns for their investors, many of whom demand those returns quickly. And that means that those newspapers get hollowed out to a greater degree than a locally owned independent publication might. So when you look at Illinois, Alden Global Capital owns Tribune Company. You've got Gannett, which owns a bunch of papers downstate. Lee Enterprises also owns a bunch of papers. And they've made very deep cuts to try to preserve cash flow and margins at those publications for as long as they can.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's lots of doom and gloom here. We've been talking about sort of the impacts of living in what's known as a news desert, the job cuts. That's something that we can't ignore as well. I mean, you look left, you looked right. Lots of media outlets have had to cut jobs. There are people who have been disproportionately affected by the loss of journalism jobs as well. But is there a silver lining to this all, Tim? Any good news here?
I am a optimistic, hopeful person by nature. And yes, there are some reasons for optimism. One is, in our report that we published just in October, we saw for the first time since we've been keeping statistics, there was a net increase of about 81 digital-only news outlets around the country. Now, 1 year doesn't make a trend. But I think if that continues, that could be a good sign for the industry, that maybe we're going to replace some of these lost newspapers with digital-only sites. We're also seeing much more visibility around the problem now. And there's a new campaign called Press Forward, which is a philanthropic effort. The MacArthur Foundation here in Chicago is helping to lead that up. There's a big Press Forward Chicago campaign with Chicago Community Trust and Joyce Foundation. McCormick Foundation also does a lot of work in local news, including with Medill. And so there's this huge push of philanthropic dollars going into local news organizations, and it's not going to solve the crisis, but it could give local news organizations enough runway to figure out a new model. And for some small organizations, it could even be a lifeline.
Yeah.
And then in Illinois is one of the states around the country that has passed legislation or public policy to help local news.
Yeah.
There was a package of bills that passed the legislature just last year. And there's going to be an infusion of about $25 million over the next 5 years in tax credits for local news organizations to hire and retain journalists.
Right.
So that's, I think, also a very positive start.
Very positive. I like to end on good news, Tim. We've been talking to Tim Franklin, director of the Medill Local News Initiative, about their recent study on the loss of newspapers and jobs across the country and here in Illinois. Thank you for the update.
All right. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Thanks for being along and join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find all of our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Sean Crawford, and Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.